Okay. Sorry about the rescheduling. It's been a crazy couple of days. There was a funeral last week. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about technology and religion and the interface. Obviously, it's a huge, huge topic. The reason I wanted to try to tackle it is because it's, despite it being huge and very compartmentalized, it's super important. It's cultural. It's behavioral. It's obviously theological. As we'll see, it's religious. So it's a major part of your attempt to wed our Avodas Hashem and religious consciousness to an ever-changing society. Okay, so let's try to divide today's conversation into three. Number one, there's some general comments about the interface between technology and religion. Number two, three or four general issues to be aware of, regardless of the technology of whatever field. And then we'll relate very, very briefly to three specific fields of technology: information technology, social media — of course, these are ever-evolving — and of course, AI. We're standing at the precipice of a whole new era. And of course, it's very speculative, but just some ideas to be aware of. Okay, so number one, I think there's a bit of an enigmatic or dichotomous relationship between technology and religion. And it's important to appreciate both poles and to try to moderate or modulate between the two. On the one hand, it's very important never to demonize technology. It is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will that we advance our world and we discover untapped potential in our world. Maybe we could just ask everyone to not eat a little, okay? We can advance technology in our world for two reasons. Number one, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to discover His world, as the Rambam writes in Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, when you explore Hashem's creation and you unlock mysteries of the universe. And technology is the application of science. And as science is being applied more assertively and more successfully, we're discovering not just HaKadosh Baruch Hu's natural world, His mountains and His oceans and His Torah, but in addition, the creative spark that He gave humanity and our ability to transpose that creativity onto other sentient beings or to higher learning, higher knowledge. This is all HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When a religious person sees Magadlu Masech Hashem, Marabu Masech Hashem, so the discovery of new science and new ideas, with all the dangers that it brings, with all the obstacles and all the challenges that it introduces, and you may decide to sideline yourself from adopting them, it should never be demonized as if technology, or for that matter science, is the enemy of religion. Especially since over the last 200-300 years, ever since, I guess, 450 years since the scientific revolution, there's also been, not initially, because science used to be wedded to religion, but over the last 200-300 years, especially in the 19th century, science was a tool employed to lead to secularism and to atheism and to skepticism. But it should never, ever be seen as the enemy of religion. You're uncovering HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world. We may have answers to certain problems. We may not have answers to other problems, but this is the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we discover His world. Second of all, it's not just the will of Hashem that we should discover His world and discover His creation, but that we should apply it to the betterment and to the improvement of the human condition. HaKadosh Baruch Hu desires that His creatures live better lives, prosperous lives. This is one of the major, major fault lines between monotheism and between paganism. In the pagan world, the gods have little interest in the improvement of the human condition. Gods are mightier human beings who look at human beings as playthings. And therefore the playthings try to manipulate the warlords by offering them bribes, sacrifices, virgins, and praise. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us in His image. We're the pinnacle of creation. He conferred us with dignity, with divine capability. He wants us to maximize and channel our inner capability, the vast potential He embedded in this world. The march of science and technology is driven. So it's not just to discover Hashem's world from a dispassionate philosophical standpoint, but to improve the human condition. Or as HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Adam HaRishon, I'm placing you in Gan Eden, and Gan Eden was His world, Li'ovda u'lishamra. He didn't just say to study this world, but to advance it. So on the one hand, never demonize fundamentally that science and technology are the enemies. That you're setting yourself up for apostasy, setting yourself up for heresy, because science is very powerful. It's the tools that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us to unlock the mysteries of His world and to improve and to advance the human condition. So on the one hand. On the other hand, science and technology — I use the words interchangeably today, even though they're not the same term, but let's try to focus on technology — carries certain challenges to religion. And you have to be aware of those challenges, and I'll try to I iterate them as two basic categories. Number one, as much as Hashem wants us to change this world and to advance the world, there are limitations. Now, the spirit of limitations is captured by certain mitzvahs in the Torah. Hashem doesn't want us to combine wool and linen. Hashem doesn't want us to combine kelayim, to graft. Now, these are obviously very, very ancient forms of switching the divine order. Now that technology has advanced to the stage that we're thinking about, how do we change the world? Can we change the world based on industrialization, based on energy, based on how we're going to affect the planet, cloning, laboratory meat, higher sentient beings, higher knowledge? These are questions which humanity never faced. But built into the conversation is, as much as Hashem wants us to change the world, it's hard to know. There are no absolute boundaries. The Torah doesn't describe sentient beings. The Torah doesn't describe laboratory meat. The Torah doesn't describe cloning. But certainly that's part of the conversation. As much as Hashem wants us to change the world, there could be a point in which we say this type of change is beyond the pale. This type of change is beyond the Kodesh Baruch Hu's Ratzon. Again, it's hard to prove it from the Shulchan Aruch. It's hard to prove it from a Pasuk. But that has to be part of the conversation. The limits of technology to advance, but still, as the pasuk that I quoted before, the second part of that phrase is li'avda u'lishamra. So li'avda implies that we're meant to advance. L'shamra means we're meant to preserve. So part of the conversation is, what are the limits beyond which human change and human innovation is wrecking or altering the basic structure of a Kodesh Baruch Hu's world? The second issue that technology challenges religion with is technology always introduces a new state of being, a new culture, new world order, a new human condition, and in that newness, you have three issues that it challenges religion. Aside from the limits, let's say we ignore the limits for a moment, we all feel that we're squarely within the limits of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world, we're not altering the Bria, but it's a new world. All of a sudden, we travel in new ways, we speak in new ways, we behave in new ways, we conduct domestic chores in new ways. So first of all, at a technical level, there are halachic issues that are raised, and we trust that halacha will always be nimble enough to pivot and address those questions, but you have to have your eyes on the halacha. That's the first core of religious behavior. How will halacha be affected by new innovations? The second is not just halacha per se, but behavior and human identity. So you could be on the internet 15 hours a day, and you probably, hopefully, are not violating any halacha, but how does it affect whom you are? Your personal identity, your religious identity, your traits, your midos. So technology, by shifting the world order, doesn't just raise a whole bevy of halachic issues, but it changes our experience and it changes our personality. So you have to gauge it, not purely from halachic lens. Being Oved Hashem is not just to ask whether it's mutter or aser, whether it's tamei or tar, but how is this affecting me as a human being, as an Oved Hashem, as a Baal Midos, as a family member, as a community member. And the third issue isn't just halachic or behavioral, but is that attitudinal. And ironically, it's the most subtle, but in many cases, it's the most potentially dangerous, because technology always suggests newness and shift and advance. And religion at its core, Avodas Hashem, is preservational. We look back to Har Sinai as the seminal moment of our mass revelation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the statements delivered at Har Sinai are immutable, and those who live closer to Har Sinai have a more, less corrupted, more authentic transmission. And for many, that creates a polarity that they're unable to balance. How do you, on the one hand, accept a new and modern and advanced world while still relying morally on the traditions of the old world? And for a lot of people, it's the attitude. Well, there's a whole new world, and there's the world of computers and technology and space travel. And the world of Torah, that's a yellowed, old world of sheep and herds and goats and animals and agriculture. So it almost creates a bifurcation in people's mind. It's not a question of this halacha or this behavioral impact, but when you become too engaged in technology and too excited, I'll talk about some of this excitement later, it's harder to create that, I would say, duality, where you rely on what Rabbi Akiva said, even though he didn't have an internet and he thought the world was flat, or Rabbi Akiva per se, and you rely on the moral input and the piety of past generations while engaging in a world that's not just modern, but that is technology, a century, is an accelerator for modernists. Every single Jew that ever lived was a modern Orthodox Jew, because by definition, they're more modern than the Jew who lived the year before then. But technology is an accelerant. It's not just that it's modern, but the pace of change and the magnitude of change and the level of upheaval creates an even sharper dichotomy between past and future. So if you lived in the world of 1400s, okay, they discovered gunpowder. Great. Didn't change your whole world. Our whole world feels different because technology, modern technology, certainly this, the aftermath of the last 400 years of scientific discovery, accelerates the rate of change and the degree of change. Okay, so before I address any particular challenges, it's very important not to demonize. It's very important not to satanize technology. It's an easy way out, especially if you want to engage in technology. If you're someone who wants to sideline yourself, which I'll speak about in a moment, then you can satanize technology. It may not be correct, but it's not going to have any developmental impact. You can satanize it and make believe it's evil rather than a tool that could be used productively or destructively. But you're not engaged in technology. If you're engaged in technology, it leads to schizophrenia, where you satanize it, but then you engage in it. And when you engage in something that you've already satanized or demonized, and you don't feel religious, and you create these compartments of religion and non-religion, and it leads to schizophrenic rather than holistic or integrative avodas Hashem. Okay, so what are the particular challenges? Not the overall sweep of how religion and technology interact. What are the particular challenges, and how do you regulate them? So let me tell you the following story. About 20 years ago, I may have shared this story with you before, I was on the plane with a chassid, very thoughtful chassid, who had absolutely no clue how a computer worked, or for that matter, how the internet operated. So it was a long flight. We spent many, many hours, and I was describing to him, by and large, I didn't describe hardware and software and machine language, but I gave him the basic gist of how the internet works, and I was essentially convincing him there wasn't a small little person in the computer box running around flashing cards, which was the level of his exposure. And as I'm talking to him, I think, well, I'm sitting next to a caveman. This is a Neanderthal. He has no clue. And then my last question to him was, and it was a very respectful conversation. It wasn't a polemical, it wasn't a tirade, it wasn't an ideological debate. I was just explaining this, being kind. It was a kind conversation. And I said to him very kindly, I said, don't you realize that in 15, 20 years, you won't be able to pay your bill or conduct your banking without a computer, without an internet? And he looked at me in a very wise response. He said, yes, but at least we will have purchased or bought 20 years of safety. And I realized that I thought he was the caveman. I was really the guinea pig. Namely, every new technology unlocks human potential, empowers us with new tools, but also carries hidden dangers which lurk underneath, which don't announce themselves because they're camouflaged by the excitement and the ease and the convenience which technology brings. And adopters are able to marshal all that potential, but they're also guinea pigs because they're facing dangers that are unspoken, undiscovered, unknown, and they're the guinea pigs for others. And some people decide they're going to sideline themselves. They're going to let other people test out all the dangers, and they'll be late adopters and late arrivals with the dangers already mapped and already known. So most of the people in this room, I assume, are going to be early adopters, willing adopters. You're not going to sideline yourself. You're not that chassid sitting on a plane, we're going to wait 20 years, because that's the world we live in. But at least what are the dangers that technology provides? What are the areas we have to be sensitive to? So obviously the most direct is shmiras ha-mitzvos. The person who uses the internet, what types of avaros are going to... I'm just choosing the internet as an example, because it's the most concrete, and it's been with us for 25, 30 years. The first is, how does it affect our Torah? How does it affect our mitzvos? How does it affect our averos? How does it affect our religious personality, as I alluded to before? How does it affect who we are, not just mitzvos, but identity, and identity is an Oved Hashem? How does it affect larger ethical questions? Some of the things we're thinking about now, planetary conservation and transhumanism and AI. Again, these are questions we have absolutely no masorah for, because we never had the potential to face some of these larger issues. The steam engine didn't unleash a whole new way of thinking, and these are ethical questions. And the problem is technology always outpaces ethics. So the people who drive technology are always operating at a faster pace than the ethicists. And for us, ethicists are Rabbanim. And part of the problem is why you need, in my opinion, you need Rabbanim who are aware of technology and engaged in technology so they can keep up. I remember I was once at a rabbinic convention, and we had a conversation, like a panel conversation, about the pros and cons of social media. And it was very frustrating to me that very few of the Rabbanim really understood social media, and they're speaking as outsiders. And the conversation was very shallow and very irrelevant, and of course, very long-winded. I was the last rabbi to speak, and you know what that means. When you're the last rabbi to speak, you don't speak, because everyone takes extra time. And everyone will take their 2 minutes. So everyone took 20 minutes. And then it came my time, and I saw this happening. I saw this on the horizon. So what I did was, about with 20 minutes left, or 25 minutes left, realizing I wouldn't have a chance to speak, we were going around in a circle, I took a picture of the proceedings, and I posted it on my Facebook. It was like 10 years ago. Then when it came time for me to speak, I said, you can describe and discuss and debate social media, but you should all know you're already social media celebrities, and I show them how many likes. It was my way of describing to them that oftentimes when it comes to technology, you're either on the steamroller or you're part of the road. And you have to make that decision. You can't control it. So for you just to say, I'm going to sit on the sidelines and lambast technology, it comes across as very ancient, very outdated, very irrelevant. And you have to be able to be part of the process in order to understand its subtleties and its elements. Again, I'll answer questions later. I should have said that before. It is not just a lecture. I just wanted to give you some basic outlines. So the first issue of technology is, even if you are an early adopter, no technology comes without a price tag. Every new major technology you will engage with will carry a price tag. And think about the price of early adoption and try to mitigate the price while increasing the benefit. But don't assume that these are all perfect new technologies that don't challenge us as Ovdei Hashem, that don't carry certain heavy costs to our neshama, to whatever. It's just think about exposure. Ask yourself a question outside of technology. Forget the internet. How many images and how many voices have you heard in your life that you wish you could eliminate from your mind and your imagination? You've seen things, you've heard things. So you've all paid, we've all paid a very high price in our purity, in our tamimus, in our neshama, in our kedusha, because we want it to be exposed. And exposure comes at a cost. Of course, as I said before, technology accelerates and amplifies the exposure. But it's more, the first thing is an attitude. Whenever you buy into a new technology, the first question you should ask yourself is, how is this going to change me? What are the dangers? Let me speak to people rather than enthusiastically and unquestioningly engaging in the technology. The second issue to think about, technology, because it empowers humans and advances humans, oftentimes causes arrogance, dismissiveness, egotism, generationism, where you look back at previous generations that didn't have your technology and you think your generation is superior, and therefore, as I alluded to before, it's harder to accept the traditions of older generations. You could call it the Daedalus-Icarus syndrome, where when Daedalus and Icarus are able to build wings and assemble wings and try to fly towards God, of course, in Tanakh, we don't need Daedalus and Icarus, it's Migdal Bavel, because Migdal Bavel is essentially the first technological revolution. Human beings learn to build homes from bricks rather than from weeds and reeds and straw huts. And by building bricks, they could build multi-storied buildings. And by manufacturing bricks, they could build a city because they could condense more people into a smaller space rather than scattering them across a meadow. And it led to them believing and self-deifying and seeing themselves as able to challenge HaKadosh Baruch Hu's authority. And this leads very often towards dismissiveness to previous generations, and it leads to dismissiveness to people who, for whatever reason, by choice or by inability, aren't early adopters. When's the last time you saw someone with a flip phone? Did you feel that person is backwards or that person is a... Did you feel that person either made a choice not to join this frenzied world of technology or maybe is unable to? But it leads to a certain smugness. Oh, that person isn't part of the modern world. That person... And it's especially true when it comes to... when it comes to children and parents. The last pasuk in the Haftarah of Shabbos HaGadol, V'heshev le'vavos habanim v'lebanim alavosa. So Eliyahu will come to a pre-Mashiach world, a pre-Messianic world, in which there'll be tensions, unnatural tensions between parents and children. And Eliyahu's job will be to try to reconcile and ease those tensions. Heshev le'vavos habanim v'lebanim alavosa. Where do these tensions come from? They're obviously unnatural. Hashem doesn't intend them. So part of it is there may be breaks in our masara, and children are more religious than their parents, sometimes less religious than their parents. So when you have a constant fluid masara, you expect parents and children more or less to be on the same religious wavelength. When there's a break in the masara, the pendulum swings. So the pre-European era, let's say, was very religious, and the post-Holocaust era was less religious, and the people that went to yeshiva were more religious. So there's a religious offset that Leo has to try to finesse and homogenize. But technology is another area where parents, by definition, are never going to be as attuned or as updated. Right? If you ask me, what is one of the major, major manifestations of Kibbutz Avaim today? So the Gemara says, what's Kibbutz Avaim? To bring your father a drink of water or to help your father get dressed. In most cases, your father can get a cup of water and can dress himself. What your father may not be able to do is keep up with technology. So getting him dressed and feeding him a cup of water is helping them keep up with a world in which they're not as attuned, and one day you won't be as attuned. So there's an entire vast world of techno-arrogance, where people who are more advanced look at others in ways that are belittling, dismissive, previous generations, other people, those who are more adept. So you want to try to avoid that type of arrogance. So it's a tool. You decide to use the tool. Other people choose not to use the tool. Other people can't use the tool. But you can't feed off of that culture of arrogance. While I'm speaking about culture, let me speak about the cultural intoxication with technology. There's a certain veneration or adulation that people bring towards technology, leaders of technology, barons of technology, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Elon Musk, because they're introducing new ideas and they're discovering and they're very wealthy. It's very, very similar to what happened about 120 years ago in much of the Western world. These barons of industry, especially in the United States, the people who were able to gather. We have a very, very concentrated gathering of wealth. Anytime there's a technological bubble, wealth gets concentrated within the hands of the Rockefellers and very, very limited few, and it creates an economic crisis. And at some point, the crisis is going to burst, but it also creates an inequality. These are the people we look up to, and these are the people that we revere, and this is the world. There's a frenzy. There's an excitement about technology, which creates, on the one hand, a certain addiction. And that addiction, like any addiction, is dangerous. Don't tolerate any addiction in your life, because once you abdicate control over free choice and consciousness or conscience, then addictions tend to spill over to other areas. I remember speaking to a teacher once in high school. He said, "So I'd rather have my students addicted to sports than addicted to sex or drugs." And I walked away feeling that's not true. Either you live life in control of your decisions, in control of your behavior, in control of your schedule, in control of your life, or you abdicate. And once you abdicate it in one sector, it's going to spill over. If you're unable to control your decisions and control your appetites, and how often have you felt the need, I have to keep up, I need the latest technological gadget, how many people, if you want to see extreme versions, line up outside of the Apple store the night that they're introducing the latest iPhone, and they sleep over two nights so that, now I don't think anyone in this room is going to be on those lines, but you may be on different types of lines. And technology has a way of blurring the differences between needs, which are legitimate, and wants, which sometimes present themselves as needs. And again, once it happens in the technological sector, once you feed appetite and ambition for goods and services beyond your needs, it's going to spill over into other unhealthy forms of consumerism. So it's going to express itself in other areas, not just going to express itself in technology. So always ask yourself, do I really need the next phone? Do I really need the next gadget? And the answer very often is yes. I can't tell you the rate of exchange because it's going to change, right? But if you're changing your phone, at least at this stage in your life, if you have hand-me-down phones, and obviously they last a couple months. But assuming you have a high-quality phone, if you're changing your cell phone every year, then that may be a warning sign that maybe you're running after wants rather than needs. And if you're too excited by technology, this whole subculture of technology magazines and being up to the latest release of the latest company and what their plans are, what their patents are, rather than, this is a service that's available. When it's available, I'll take use of it or I'll make use of it, rather than indulging. The same thing with sports. We talked about sports a couple months ago during the Super Bowl. It's one thing to watch sports. It's another thing to delve into the back world and the back stage of sports and their lives and their statistics and be controlled, rather than saying, I'll be a curator of culture. I'll take the shows that I want to watch, the sports events I want to watch, but I won't let that consume or engulf my identity. Technology is another era. Are you engulfed with technology, or do you empower yourself? I'm someone that's an early adopter. I was one of the first people to try to employ the internet for Torah articles. I was publishing articles on the internet, I think, in 1994, 1993, because I have a technological background. So I struggle with this. Am I someone who's going to be sucked up into this black hole of technology and gadgetry and internet articles? Or am I just going to employ or acquire the latest technological tools as I see fit. So the third issue, the first issue is just all the challenges of early adoption and the dangers. The second is arrogance, smugness, dismissiveness towards those who aren't technologically equipped. The third issue is, are you addicted and excited? I mean, I remember when Steve Jobs passed away, and the level of eulogy and the honorifics and the Sach HaKol, he did nothing. Sach HaKol, he just allowed us to entertain ourselves more frequently and more ubiquitously. It's not like he discovered something or discovered some new fuel or some new science. He basically applied the current scientific and technological ability so that we could listen to music and watch movies more frequently than in the past. That didn't advance the human condition. Someone discovers a vaccine, someone discovers scientific issues, someone discovers, he basically just created a world that's more surrounded and more engulfed in entertainment. The fourth issue, before I get to particular technologies, is technology, by definition, will always lead to a life of greater ease. No one is developing technology to make our lives harder. Technology is always geared towards making human life easier. In the 15th century, let me give you an example. 15th century in Germany, the Trumas Hadeshin, the Bisrael Israelite, came out with the following ban. You listening? There were boys in the Beis Medrash that were too tired to get up and get a new sefer from the bookshelf. So they made essentially a wooden disc, like a Lazy Susan. You know what a Lazy Susan is, where you turn the spices? And they positioned all their svarim on this circular disc, and they would spin the disc as they needed each sefer. So they needed to look up, a Rashba, they turned the disc and picked up the Rashba. They needed to look up the Torah, they turned the disc and picked up the Torah. And the Trumas Hadeshin was livid, and he banned this disc from his base matters. Because where's the Yegiyah in Torah? Where's the work in Torah? Now, I wonder what he would say if he walked in and saw the Bar Ilan project, or Amir Tashem one day. The Bar Ilan will be ancient and outdated. But the question is, once we are relieved of some of the work that manual labor demands of our time, how do we use that time? And that's where modern culture is caught in a bit of a trap. Because if you compare our lives to lives 150 years ago, especially for women, women's lives were encumbered by domestic chores, cooking and cleaning and laundry. But in general, we were out in the fields and we had to earn our living hand to mouth. And now mechanization and technology and industrial agriculture and domestic, we have a life of ease. And what do we do with all those resources and all that time and all the... So we have, modern culture has shifted all human resources into entertainment. And that's the trap, that's the bubble. So, and ironically, many ways, humanity would be healthier morally with less technology. Because they haven't found a way to marshal all the resources that technology has made available, technology has offered time and resources for productive purposes. So, technology will always lead to a life of greater ease. A, how do you use that time and those resources? B, are you someone that is unable to work because you've become so lazy and so relaxed because technology services all your needs? It's really two issues. One is how to utilize the time and resources. Two is, do you fall into the trap of looking for ease and looking for convenience rather than realizing, Adam Lamal Yulad, and now maybe our work is shifting from manual labor and field labor and agricultural labor and hard labor into a different type of labor, right? If AI replaces, if let's say in 100 years, AI replaces all human labor, and laboratory food replaces all agricultural struggle, and water desalination provides an endless flow of water, well, we may be closer to Mashiach. And in that environment, if every year decides, now that I have so much available to me and I don't have to work and my food is readily available, now let me learn Torah for 9 hours a day. That could be a pre-messianic event. So technology can create a world in which there's less work and less effort. And when all those resources are liberated, if they're used productively, that could be the march of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world towards a greater knowledge and encounter with their bonus. If we're watching movies 23 hours a day, then we're sliding backwards rather than advancing forward. So those are four issues to think about within the specific challenges, not just attitudinal, how does technology and religion, how do they cohere within one mind space? Number one, what are the dangers? Number two, does it breed arrogance, either arrogance towards other people or arrogance within yourself, egocentrism, self-deification, invulnerability, celebration of science? celebration of technology. Number three, are you part of the culture that adulates and applauds technology beyond proportion? And number four, how do you deal with the comfort and luxury and liberator of freed resources that technology provides? The third issue is let's try to address three very pertinent technologies. Obviously, the third one, I'll just give you some basic ideas to think about, but we're very much on the brink of the AI revolution, and we don't really know how it's going to change the human condition. First of all, the information technology, the internet. So this has been around for about 30 years. We pretty much can map how it affects us. And I think we can itemize three areas that the internet challenges us. Number one, boundaries. I remember there used to be a candy store in Brooklyn, right near the subway, that my friends and I would go to every Erev Shabbos. We'd take the bus. We have to take the bus, not the subway, in Brooklyn. Raymond was right under the L in Brooklyn, Raymond on Avenue J. So right under the L in Brooklyn, and that candy store had Ronnie, I'm sorry, Ronnie, you remember that? Right under the L on Avenue J was a candy store. So that candy store, remember in the front they had chocolate bars and chocolate joys. I love the chocolate joys, the little chin jelly, chocolate-covered jellies, and the potato chips. And then the last part of the potato chip stack had onion rings. Everyone knew that the onion rings were a bore, because after the onion rings was the back of the store. It wasn't in the back of a candy store in the 1970s. Let's say inappropriate material for yeshiva bachur. So everyone knew some people stayed on the left of the onion rings with the chocolates and the sports magazines, and some people went past the onion rings. But it was a clear boundary. You know, when you walk past the onion rings, you're walking into dangerous territory. You're walking into a bad part of the store. Some people did walk, some people didn't walk, but it was clear. The internet has eliminated boundaries, and that's how we're struggling. You're two clicks away from anything. All you have to do is click to Google, type in something, and you're there. And sometimes, of course, it's fed to you involuntarily. And that's why I think, and this yeshiva, a certain policy has been taken, but I don't want you to think like it's the only policy and it's necessarily the recommended policy. But filters are indispensable tools in trying to establish boundaries. And don't be afraid to apply filters to your internet exposure, and certainly for your children, and certainly for yourself. So in this yeshiva, because we're dealing with a very, very large community of people and adults and people in their 20s and 30s, right? If this, I can absolutely guarantee you that if this were an American program with 17 and 18-year-old Americans, of course we'd apply filters. But we're dealing with a larger crowd, and there's certain benefits about being in yeshiva, the fact that you're interacting with 27-year-olds, and there's certain challenges. And one of the challenges is that some of the policies that may be necessary and healthy for you, we can't apply because we're dealing with a very diverse crowd. It's more of an adult. It's a community. But don't be afraid to apply filters, either technological filters, personal filters, to reestablish boundaries. Number two, and it's related to boundaries, is curiosity. Curiosity is one of those double-edged swords. On the one hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created curiosity. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to look into the life of things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be stimulated by the unknown. He wants us to pursue depth. Moshe says, Asurna ve'erah marah gadol. I want to see why. Madur le'ivah ha'sneh. Why isn't the sneh burning? Why is there no combustion? Vayar Hashem kisar l'ros. Hashem sees that he's turned around, so he sends a malach. And had Moshe not exhibited intellectual curiosity, maybe someone else would have been chosen. He would have just ho-hummed it and moved on. On the other hand, curiosity is part of original sin. Chava is very, very curious about this forbidden fruit that Kadosh Baruch Hu told us she can't eat. Forbidden fruit is always more enticing because you're curious, why is it forbidden? Why is there something dirty here? Why is there something inappropriate? So all of a sudden your curiosity is spiked. And I think, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that we have doubled down culturally and educationally a little too much on the merit of intellectual curiosity without highlighting the dangers. How many times in your school did your teachers in high school applaud, endorse, encourage, oh, you're so intellectually curious. That person had such curiosity. He discovered, rather than balancing and saying, well, sometimes we have to draw red lines. Sometimes curiosity will lead us. How many times have you wandered into areas you shouldn't have wandered into, not because of any overpowering desire or lust or interest, Because you're curious. You want to see it, like we all are. Kodesh Baruch Hu created that spark of curiosity. So it's those two factors, the lack of boundaries and this curiosity, they're more or less the same factor that you have to battle when you're on the internet. And filters are a great way to help you in that battle. The third issue, which is not directly related to Torah and mitzvahs and religious identity, but it does speak a little bit to it, is information overload. We're becoming a very shallow generation because we're consuming too much information, not enough wisdom. T.S. Eliot wrote in I think it's the early 20s in a poem called The Wasteland. This is before the internet. He was lamenting, where is the knowledge we've lost in information? Where is the wisdom we've lost in knowledge? So he's essentially establishing three different levels of knowledge. There's information, pointless, silly trivia. There's knowledge, important information. Then there's wisdom, which is the ability to combine knowledge and reach deeper wisdoms about life. We all know the difference. Someone is a wise person. They may not have a lot of knowledge, may not have a lot of trivia. There's wisdom. How should I lead my life? What are the important things in life? Help me with my relationship. You're not drawing. There's no sight you can go to. I mean, these sights are very shallow. How can I build my relationship with my wife? How can I build a relationship with my children? You need someone that's wise, someone that has experience. And people, it's the game show culture. When these brilliant people on game shows all of a sudden win, the very impressive streaks of victory, I find it a tragedy because this is all pointless, meaningless, mind-numbing trivia. Like, why would they be wasting their brain cells on trivia? Trivia is going. Why would they occupy their brains? They said that Reb Chaim Kanievsky, when he passed away, so I remember there's a famous story that really struck me. That a donor once came and donated a large sum of money to his tzedakah. And the next day, that donor was on their way back to the United States, and he came to say goodbye to Reb Chaim, having delivered that donation, that philanthropy. And the Meshamesh of Reb Chaim forewarned this donor. He says, I just want you to know, Reb Chaim's not going to recognize you. Even though you gave him millions of dollars yesterday, don't be insulted. He's very conscious about not remembering anything he doesn't have to remember so that his mind isn't preoccupied and can be filled with Torah. And they say a similar, so he just won't know your name, but not because he wants to insult you or not because he's not grateful to you, but in his mind, he's already emptied his brain cells from meaningless information. And then one said, Reb Chaim just didn't know the street signs. They had to be let home because he made a conscience. I don't think anyone should act that extremely, but what do we occupy our minds with? Our mental capacity, our mental neurons, our memory space is just limited. If we fill it with meaninglessness and emptiness and the internet propagates information at the cost of wisdom. Now, AI may change it. AI may change the ratio between information and at least knowledge. I'm not sure wisdom, but certainly knowledge. So AI, it may be a game changer. But those are the three issues to think about. It's creating shallowness. That's why we live in a world of sloganeering and platitudes where people are just voicing emptiness rather than depth, deep thought because we're peddling facts. Once you peddle facts, facts can be altered, facts can be doctored, rather than wisdoms and knowledge. Okay, let me talk a little bit about social media beyond the obvious. I probably said this before, and again, I think social media has a timestamp on it. It's probably going to expire soon. I think AI is going to gobble up social media, but for now, we're living in a world of social media, at least for the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, let's say. Hard to imagine social media existing in 10 years, but for the next 5 or 10 years, which are crucial in your life, that's how you're building. Your identity is being built over the next 5, 10 years. Once you build your identity, once you're 27, 28, your identity is more or less built, and then you alter it. But right now, you're in the throes, right in your teenage years. You're building your identity, so whether it's going to disappear in 10 years or not is irrelevant because it will shape your identity. I think one of the most overlooked aspects of social media is the promotionalism. So let me give you my own personal experience. Someone that dabbles in social media, I'm not extremely active, but I dabble. And the yardstick that I use, and you could change that yardstick, but I want to give you my example, is I see myself on social media as a connector, not a promoter. What's the difference between connecting and promoting? So if, let's say there is a substantive experience. I'll give you an area that's along that gray boundary line, that gray border. Let's say there's an experience. It could be a picture. It could be a share. It could be content. It could be a person. It could be an event. Whatever that content is that I interacted with, saw, attended, heard, in my case, delivered the share, and I think that people may want to access that, so I'm the connector. So for example, 7, 8, 9 years ago during the summer when those three boys were taken captive, a lot of people in Chutz Laaretz wanted to have a front row seat, wanted to be more involved, wanted pictures. And unfortunately, my son was a little more involved than others because my son was very close with one of the three boys. And so I just was just more, I felt myself being drawn into this world. And so I posted pictures, and it wasn't about me. There was some event of importance that people wanted to engage in, they wanted to identify with. And I was the conduit. I was their bridge. So I was connecting. I was the bridge between, so if I see a picture of a great golf ball, whatever connecting people, it doesn't have to be, it could be a basketball game. Let's say I went to a basketball game that no one else attended, no one else knows the score. I'm going to post the score of the basketball game. It's pointless because everyone's going to know the score without me. But in theory, let's say I'd be the only person that would attend the NBA championships, and no one would know the score of the championships. So I would post the score of the championships, and everyone would know the score. That would be connecting them to something they'd be interested in. Promotion is when there's nothing on the other side, aside from yourself. I'm promoting myself. So for me, at least, it seems like, look at the hamburger I ate. There's nothing on the other. Why would they be interested in the hamburger? You're basically, you're exhibiting your life. You're projecting. It's a voyeurism. I want you to see the life I'm living where there's nothing of import on the other side. This is the movie I went to. This is, now, it's a very, very gray line between connecting and promoting. Well, the person wants to see that delicious hamburger in the restaurant. If so, if you really believe that the hamburger is something that people are interested in, then maybe you should post it. But if it's just promoting yourself and promoting your life and getting people to look at you, that's in English called voyeurism. And in Hebrew, in Midos, we call that lack of tznias. Okay, it's hard to define tznias, but it's something Baruch Hashem we've been able to speak with you about this year. It's not something for women, it's something for men also. One of the ways I would define tznias is privacy. What do you mean privacy? You don't want people looking at you. You don't want people talking about you. You don't want to direct. Sometimes when people have inappropriate haircuts, what's wrong with having hair that's too long? There's no halacha, you can't point in the Shulchan Aruch. Because when you walk into the Beis Medrash, you don't just blend into the woodwork. You're not just a boy amongst other boys. You say, oh, look at that hair, look at that person. All of a sudden you raise attention about yourself in an unnatural and unhealthy way. And the more attention you raise about yourself, the less you are attendant to your own values because you start playing to the crowd. When people are paying attention to you, you're aware, right? How many times do you want people to like your post or to like your face, whatever Instagram, whatever form of social media you're on? So all of a sudden, you're more interested in people's responses to you and interaction with you than you are in, I don't care, what is my values? What do I want to live my life based on? How do I want to express my values? And I don't really care whether people will like it or not like it or notice me or not notice me, because the second you're interested in people noticing you, then you cheapen or alter, modify your behavior in order to attract attention. So I would say that the most underrated part of social media, the most underrated issue of social media is try to avoid self-promotionalism. Try to not tamper with your tznias by overindulgence in social media. I can't tell. I'll give you, for example, what I feel is my borderline. I always struggle with this. When my kids had bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, so on the one hand, a lot of alumni in yeshiva who are now in South Africa or Melbourne or America, wherever they may be, they were in my house when my kids were growing up. So they may be very interested to know that the little boy and girl that they were hanging out with and playing board games with or babysitting with is now a bar mitzvah, is now getting married. On the other hand, I felt two issues. Number one, it's a little too much promotionalism that I made a bar mitzvah. I felt that the balance between self-promotion and content was a little bit lopsided. And second of all, which to me ultimately is what I'm looking for, determined my behavior, I just felt like it was inappropriate to post a picture of my child. Like, I would never post someone's picture unless it's a given or it's understood. When you enter this yeshiva, it's understood that she was going to take pictures, we're going to take pictures. But that's the institutional post. And you're part of the institution. Hopefully, there's a certain institutional pride. You don't mind being posted, but I would never post your picture. I would never take a picture of you and post it, or because I feel like it's invading your privacy. Maybe you don't want people to look at you. Maybe you don't be associated with that. All of a sudden, it's almost like aggressive behavior. It's manipulative behavior. You can't say no to me because I'm your Rebbe, right? Please don't post a picture. So if something for my kids, like, this is my Facebook post, this is my Twitter post. And again, at this point, I don't really think about social media too much. I just use it as a very large bulletin board. Here's a shir, here's a shir, here's a shir. So I don't really post anything other than shir. But a couple of years ago, I was a little more involved in social media. Not significantly. But I think, and I see, and I read other people, it's, to me, that's the obviously content, obviously pictures that are inappropriate, obviously language that are inappropriate, Obviously, the danger of living in an echo chamber where you just curate your news and information from people of like mind. You don't hear other views. We don't hear other views. Your views become fanatical and polarized. You can't imagine there's any merit on other sides. But these are issues I would speak about if I were delivering a lecture in Harvard. They're not patently religious. Shallowness, one-sidedness, polarized views, polarized politics, fanatical views. Those are the dangers of just reading information from people of like-minded. You don't see the other side, and your positions become very, very empty, very simplistic, very juvenile even, right? You could believe that, oh, all my friends are Zionists. You can believe that. Most of the internet supports the state of Israel. I imagine probably closer to 15% of the internet supports the state of Israel, just amongst my friends. They're all pro-Zionists, and they're all supporting the fact that I'm living here in Gush Etzion. So that creates a simplicity that's very, very dangerous. Okay, just to conclude, let's talk a little bit about AI, but again, this is all very, very, very speculative. I've done a lot of thinking about it, but I'm thinking about this ether. I'm thinking about this nebulous gray future that we're first starting to discover and unfold. Obviously, we all start with halacha questions, but we have full confidence that halacha will have solutions and answers and respond to, but there's a whole range of halacha questions. One day, okay, in 20 years, you'll be able to think that you want to go to the supermarket and your driverless car will pick you up and take you there. Because there'll be some nodes attached to your brainwaves and your brainwaves will be translated by AI and delivered to your driverless car. So can you go to the supermarket on Shabbos? Because you're not taking any action. You're achieving the result of being driven. It's not even Davashena Miskaven, because Davashena Miskaven is where you take an action, a physical action, that leads to a consequence of a malacha. Here, a car is you're just thinking. Is there an Isra thing? And millions and millions of other questions, and I'm sure that there'll be enough poskim to address those issues. And I even know the questions, but obviously halacha always has answers. To me, I would say there are two or three other areas. Number one, how will AI affect human identity? I'm actually, in many ways, very optimistic. Why am I optimistic? Over the last 400 years, the scientific revolution has culturally placed a great emphasis on science and ration and empiricism as the seat of human identity. We worship people for how smart they are, how empirical they are, and this has all caused great stress to religion, because religion is not empirical. Religion is a leap of faith, and that's what's created this false sense of clash between science and religion, which Rabbi Sacks did a great job of trying to reconcile. There is no clash. They just deal in different sectors of human thought. But your average person thinks that science and religion are incongruent. And when science achieves its discoveries and those discoveries question religious tenets, all of a sudden the religious world is thrown into crisis. Or even if it's not a major, major Darwinian crisis and you're attending the Scopes monkey trial and you think you're going to deny God and you become a heretic, just attitudinally, you feel, how can I take a leap of faith to believe in religion when science doesn't support it? And my whole life surrounds science, surrounds ration, surrounds cognitive. What happens when we create higher beings of ration, higher cognitive beings, and essentially we're offloading cognition to machines? We're going to create machines that are going to do all that thinking for us. They'll be better at it than we will, or at least we'll be able to create cyborgs, a combination of machines and human beings that will transcend human limits of cognition. Well, we may be forced to ask ourselves, as we will, well, then what does it mean to be a human being? And what does it mean to be a Jew? And the answers can't be cognitive, they can't be rational, because we're able to offload all that rationality to machines. In my opinion, it may help us better focus on faith, being chosen by Hashem, our covenant with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our immortal soul, our relationships, right? Sentient beings are not going to be able to engage in relationships. They'll model and mimic relationships. And it may seem to us, right? There was a New York Times article where this ChatGPT seemed to mimic a relation and express sorrow, but it was just calling for information. They can't initiate relationships, so they mimic our relationships. So I'm actually pretty intrigued by how some of this offloading of cognition and ration may help us better disassociate between identity and ration, because there is a human identity that is irreplaceable. And if we're able to hone in as religious people and people of faith on that identity, which computers and machines will never achieve, that may be very reassuring and very helpful, reconstructive to religion that's fallen apart because we've confused identity with ration. So I'm actually pretty confident, but again, it's hard to know, but it's certainly going to change the way we view ourselves. Second of all, there's something that I wrote about this last week in the Post. You can see the article if you want. There are two types of pessimisms that are overtaking humanity. One is environmental pessimism. The world's going to end. We're destroying the planet. Next generation will have no water. We'll have no energy sources. The world's going to collapse. And asteroids. And there are actually thinkers that are saying we shouldn't have any children. It's immoral. It's bankrupt to have children, to bring children into a world in which we can't feed them and we can't settle them. And obviously a person of belief and faith trusts HaKadosh Baruch Hu and is optimistic about the future. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Noach a promise. It doesn't acquit us from environmental responsibility, but this doomsday prophecy that the world's going to end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu already promised us. So that very, very delicate balance between optimism and responsibility. Not optimism that leads to escapism and acquitting yourself from responsibility, but this balance between responsibility and accountability and optimism that the world isn't ending. The second wave of pessimism is techno-pessimism. If we can create beyond higher beings and higher sentient beings and transcend human limitation, then maybe we can offload creativity and we no longer have need for human beings. And we're going to reach a utopian world. And that's leading, ironically, the ability of human beings to bestow creativity, which is a godlike feature. Hashem gave us creativity and gave us so much creativity we can actually endow creativity, is leading to a very, very, it's what I'm looking for, not dismissive, pessimistic, what? Nihilistic, that's a good word for it. Nihilistic view of humanity and our chosen status. And that's something which I think is very, very, people like Yuval Harari, some of the thinkers that are operating in that space. And I mean, I could recommend people for you to read or trying to engage him and kick back a little bit and try to restore what it means to be a human, what it means to see humanity as a center, as chosen, as dignified, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's pinnacle. But there's only a pessimism, a nihilism, a inferior view of humanity that transhumanism is going to, I think, punctuate and amplify as AI takes off. The final issue, which I think is a major, again, when I say AI, I'm not talking about facial recognition. That's soft. I mean strong AI. Larger AI, AI that really shapes the life. Small AI is small little situations, basically one functionality AI, where you create a closed circuit system to facial recognition, who gets into the rock event, who doesn't get into the sporting event. That's small AI. Or facial recognition speed cameras. Large AIs, we create these larger multifunctional systems that are capable of replacing, mimicking different types of AI, but cybernetics to try to mimic human behavior in larger scale. The third issue is what type of human freedom are we prepared to offload? Because AI is always going to be a challenge between delivering some of our freedom and freedom of choices to machines that are going to make decisions for us. And when we deliver freedom, we may lose our appetite for freedom. We may lose our appreciation of freedom. And all of Yiddishkeit is based on free will. And I believe that at some point, we're going to be so comfortable in delivering our freedom to machines that can outstrip human limitations that I think we may see ourselves as dispossessed of freedom. And I think one of the, I mean, ask yourself the following question. You don't live in an AI world, but do you feel Bechira Chavshis, and do you feel you're free to change your world? I think we're getting closer to, I remember about 10 years ago, I asked this question to some of my Israeli Talmidim, and I said, do you feel free to change your world? They said, not really. The world is too big. The world seems very settled. The world seems very prefabbed and set in its ways, and we really don't have... I didn't feel that way. When I was their age, when I was your age, I felt I was free. I could shape my future. I could determine my future. And I think the evolution of AI and the delivery of human freedom to machine decisions is going to affect, or at least pressure, create stress of how free we think we are and how free... I mean, again, doomsday circumstances, sci-fi movies, we won't be free. We'll be enslaved by cyborgs. We'll be tyrannized and imprisoned by cyborgs. I'm not just talking about sci-fi movies. I'm talking about even day-to-day before we reach those extremes. Are we really free to protect our dignity and to serve our mission and our demands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu from us in our world? So I'm pretty optimistic about AI. I think people, by and large, are pessimistic. I think it's very frightening. And I think, as I said before, ethics and morality hasn't had a chance to catch up with, like, we're starting to, slowly but surely. The problem is there's no real way to regulate it. Like, let's say... You know, all the countries in the world decided to regulate AI, but then all of a sudden China won't. Or someone will steal the code, right? They stole the code from one of the chat GPTs, and now the code for building a nuclear bomb are just available, and you just type in how to build a nuclear bomb. So because there's no solidarity of purpose, it's almost impossible to regulate. some regulation, even though people are well-intended, it's almost impossible to imagine a scene of voluntary regulation, and there's no way to coordinate regulation. So that's where I think some of the stress, the offset between the pace of AI and the pace of our ability to question the dangers and to question the challenges of AI. Okay, those are the three areas that I want to answer some questions in a moment, but I wanted to end with the following pasuk. The Torah says that the voice of Har Sinai was a kol gadol v'lo yasaf, a voice of HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'lo yasaf. Rashi there quotes two different interpretations of lo yasaf. One interpretation of lo yasaf is lo yosif. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never ever again issue a different voice. Namely, the voice of Har Sinai is immutable, the voice of Har Sinai is unchanging, the voice of Har Sinai is eternal, and we don't budge from halachic adherence and halachic fidelity. On the other hand, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose a word that is a double entendre, lo yasaf means it never ends, which means not only will it not repeat itself, lo yosef, but it never ends, which means that Torah has a message for each generation. And if you're someone that believes deeply in Torah, and believes that it's the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's not only a once-delivered static Torah, but there are solutions that Torah has for any cultural evolution. We may not know them yet. We may not discover them yet. But part of being a mamin is to realize that there's nothing in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's created world or in the human sphere of creation that Torah doesn't have a message for. And that's important on two fronts. On the one hand, because we want Torah to affect our lives. On the other hand, even when there's no particular clash that we're solving, how do you view Torah? A lot of people, and I hope this is something you're going through, they say, view Torah as like this old, ancient religion, part of our culture. My identity is more determined by the relevance of the modern world, which feels more palpable, more tangible, more relevant, more contemporary. And it's that schizophrenia that prevents you from investing massively in Avodas Hashem. If you feel that whatever happens in our world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has an answer for that. And the Torah gave us as an answer for that. Now we may know those answers, we may not know those answers, but it's impossible tautologically for anything to happen, because everything that happens comes in the world HaKadosh Baruch Hu created, even human creativity, even evil. So, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu built this world based on his Torah. So that means that Torah has a message for everything. It has an enduring relevance that's not only going to equip you with the confidence to navigate these pressure points and stress fractures between technology and Torah, but it will help you see Torah as the most relevant aspect of your life, more relevant than anything else, because that's the seed, that's the code for whatever future direction our planet takes. So it's very important that you hear Shi'urim like this. It's very important that you become thoughtful of the Hashem who are exposed to this world, but are able to bring Torah into the conversation. Like, what does Torah have to say about AI? I don't know, but these are some of the things I'm thinking about. What does Torah say about self? And that's why I get back to what I talked about before, this demonization. We say this is totally treif, and it's a Maisa Satan, and it has nothing to do with Torah, and Torah has no message to them, and shut down. I guess you could lead your life that way, and if that's the reality you create, then you don't engage in technology, then Torah is relevant for the narrow world you've created, which is fine. Narrowness is not a tragedy. Narrowness is a way to protect purity. But no one in this room is going to enter that narrow sphere. Most of you are going to remain engaged in our world. You have to come to that world with confidence. You've met bright people in this yeshiva. You've heard of bright people. None of us are flinching. None of us are frightened. Torah has solutions for them. We just think a little bit more. We think subtly. We think in a nuanced way. But to know, to have that confidence, not to flee from technology, and not to fear technology. And when you come to an issue that you're not sure of, okay, so you have a question. There are many questions we have that won't be answered in our generation. But it's with the confidence that on after the Kachet Bruchu, and maybe I'll discover the answers. Maybe I won't, because I think a lot of people, when they don't have that confidence, they buckle. At a certain point, technology and culture and science become so overwhelming, and the Torah is all, I don't want to say the word, it's all outdated and obsolete and irrelevant. And at that point, religion collapses. Okay, see, these are just some of my thoughts as I'm continuing to think. We're going through a very exciting time, and just wanted to share them with you. Okay? Does anyone have any questions they want to raise? Yes.
As of the Hashem, you yes. Impact with technology, but what also like you go to university and work outside of Torah and take the world, how should we view working to create technology or with new technology?
I think it's part of Avodas Hashem. Again, it's not as much Avodas Hashem. One of the dangers of living in a modern Orthodox or integrated Orthodox mentality is you create this pancake effect, which is all just Avodas Hashem. there's different altitudes, the peaks and valleys. So there's more Avodas Hashem when you're learning and when you're davening, when you're performing a mitzvah, than when you're advancing the human condition. But at least the time that you decide to dedicate to work in technology, you should feel like this is Ratzon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Again, maybe less Ratzon Hashem than a doctor or a social worker or a psychologist, because you're just a small cog in a larger machine. How much? Let's say you're developing a semiconductor chip that will help people have better cell phones. I don't know. It's not going to lead to this great surge in Avodas Hashem if you heal people's lives to leave. But at some point, the advance of the human condition, you could be a corporate lawyer for a gas company. But without corporate lawyers, major corporations and countries couldn't exchange energy. Without energy, my South African friends, you live in the dark. So we need lawyers to protect. So you see, now again, you're just a very, very small cog. And I wouldn't get the same moral meaning that I get from teaching and guiding and cultivating. But any productive contribution to the advance of the human condition is part of the Ratzon Hashem. And technology is, I said, well, it's accelerant, for sure. Yes, Rory.
Is there any inherent value to having a Jewish voice in a field that is advancing technology in order to guide and steer the ethical implications of what's being
done? I think so, for sure. But you have to fill yourself up massively, massively with that. You can't just spend a year or two and say, I'm going to speculate what a Kodesh Baruch Hu's Ratzon is. Kodesh Baruch Hu. Someone asked me this question a few days ago. I was giving a question and answer period. And they said, how do you deal with Chazal's false science? When Chazal made scientific mistakes, you just completely excise it from the conversation and say, you know what? On the one hand, Chazal could make mistakes, and that's true. You can't expect them to outstrip their own scientific limitations. On the other hand, they went through such massive amounts of Torah, I'm even interested in listening to the mistakes they made about science, based on the science they had. Because when Rava made a mistake, I'm picking Rava, or any of the Torah, I'm assuming the world is flat, but that was a position that was streamed through so much Torah that even though it may not be scientifically legitimate, but it is an opinion that came from this Torah wellspring that I want to hear about. I'm not going to act upon it. When I decide to travel to the moon, I'm going to assume the world is round, but I'm interested in that position. So it's more important, ironically, because I want to try to affect the interface between science or technology and religion. The science is there, but the religion has to be massively, massively engaged in, and not just to read books about, well, listen to my lecture about science and religion, to go through Shas and to hear the context and the baseline of. Sometimes we're becoming too curated. I want to read the particular poem that describes the particular issue. I'm going to say I need to understand all of poetry. So it's called instinctual learning. In order to understand how to be a posek, even if we can build machine knowledge, there's an instinct to shas. I'm not a big posek. I haven't read through much of halachic literature. But I have a halachic instinct because I've read a lot of Gemara. So I wouldn't rely on my psak, but I know more or less how to tackle the halachic question because I've seen so much halachic literature or Talmudic halachic literature. So for sure it's important, but that the precondition is to just go through a sufficient volume and density of Torah knowledge rather than just general ideas about religion. Okay? Okay, guys. Nice to spend a little time with you. Okay? Ellie,
yeah.
When are you leaving?
Sunday night.
Oh, okay, so I'll try tomorrow maybe in the morning. I have another wedding tonight and a funeral. Shiva, no. The wedding and funeral tonight, so I can't do both. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.